Now today, I'm going to speak about a subject which I find to be interesting for me, and I hope it will also be interesting for you. Last week, I received two complaints about the way I present myself on this camera. The complaints were, why do you say things like, I don't know what to talk about, I have no idea what to talk about? Because, they say, you always know what to talk about, and after a short while, you always speak about things. So better to not make this excuse and to just get right into it. And another person complained, why at the end of the lecture do you say that sometimes you didn't think it was a very good discussion, or maybe it was a little confused, or you hope that everybody got something out of it? You should know that they always do. So I was thinking about this. Actually, I was thinking about this a lot, because these comments were good from the point of view of, shall we say, a broadcaster, somebody who is going to do a television show would never say such a thing. A person who is doing a recording of a video, an interview perhaps, would never say such a thing. They would always present everything as, this is the way it is, and the way it is perfect, and I am saying everything just right. And you should all be very impressed with what I'm saying. Now, I understand that. It's not that I don't have any experience with broadcasting in a live format. I've done a lot of radio shows in my time, been on TV, and so on. But this experience that we're having here together is quite different. It is very much a personal communication. It is very much a, shall we say, a presentation of the way I have experienced my recent days or the period of time between broadcasts. It is a sharing. I have even explained that when I give my explanation of the broadcasting and what I do. It's a sharing. The sharing means that I am sharing with you my consciousness at this present moment. Often when I'm speaking here in this broadcast, especially in the beginning, I am coming from a very difficult technological setup. I'm not going to bore you with those details. You know, you've heard it before. And sometimes just before I start, everybody is desperately trying to connect to me using TACONF. And generally, they can't do it because it's a little bit tricky, especially since I'm doing everything on a Mac and I'm using VMware Fusion and various emulators of Windows. And my networking is very complex in this house. So today, I just told everybody, sorry, it doesn't work. I'm not going to do it. Because for me to struggle with your technological problems too is very difficult. So for me to share properly, I have to just be freed from the stress of having to accomplish more than I can do. When I was considering these comments where people were saying, and I know a lot of others have thought it too. It's not that I'm insensitive to that. The idea being you should present yourself as, and I'm going to use this word perhaps a little bit hesitantly, an authority. That what you are presenting is not bad at all. You should never feel hesitant. You should never feel lack of confidence. You should present it because it is good, it is right. Gandhi once said something I thought was very nice, and that was that anybody, regardless of how wise or expert they may think they are, would do well to understand that even the wisest person can make mistakes, and even the most expert person can fail. I personally find that to be something that inspires me. It's not something that discourages me. The idea that I have to be vigilant in case there's some mistake. For example, in this broadcasting, I have to be vigilant. Every now and then I'll look to see, I have the monitor over there on this side, so I'm looking to see, do I still sit in the center of the screen? I mean, that's an important point. If I was over here and I'm talking to you, you would go, gee, that's strange. Where is he? Or if I was up here or something like this. So I have to make sure, am I in the center of the screen? Which is actually not so simple in this room, because I sit here so often, there are holes in the floor where the wheels of my chair go. So my chair generally wants to fall in those holes. And if I was to allow it to do that, I would sit over here. So I have to force the chair. I have to move the wheels. Very careful balance has to be here. I can't move the chair, otherwise, bloop, it'll fall in the holes. So even though you may think that's a simple thing, it's actually not so simple. It's like a balancing act here. Then there's like, is everybody seeing anything at all? Are they hearing anything at all? Has something terrible happened somewhere? So I have to be vigilant to make sure that mistakes don't happen, so that your experience of this broadcast is painless and effortless. That I am assuming all of the trouble of this technological web, so that your experience is painless. Now, why am I doing that? Well, I'm doing that because if your experience is not painless, then anything I would say would be mixed with your anxiety, would be mixed with your struggle, and it would render anything I would say useless. There would be no value in it. It would be more or less a waste of time. So I'm vigilant, thinking that mistakes can occur. So I have to be one step ahead of the mistakes. I know that regardless of how good I am at computers, and really, compared to the way other people are, I can tell you I'm pretty expert. I've realized that seeing the way other people deal with their computers. So, but however good I may be at this, and there are others who are 100% better than me, but I have to be aware of my failures. I have to be aware of my limitations. When I reach my limitations, I have to say it. I have reached my limitation. I cannot do it any better than this. I'm at the roof of it. Now, this limitation business is a very interesting concept, because what is it that's limiting it? I'm going to get into that a little bit later on, because I want to share with you again this idea of my doubts. Or maybe they're not really doubts at all. Maybe it's just my way of discovery, my way of uncovering. A lot of people speak about the reason why we're here in this world as being spirit's desire to accept some kind of burden or to accept some kind of challenge, whereby the spirit is now embodied and has to find its way back to its spiritual consciousness, the essence of what it is. And this challenge to find your way back, this is a theme that's in every religion of the world. Sometimes they call that back heaven. Sometimes, for example, in the Vedic idea, you call that back the spiritual realm or Vaikuntha or whatever. But this idea being to get back, that there was something and I've got to get back to it. This brings up a fascinating discussion. The fascinating discussion is, what is that back? Is that my goal? Is it really my goal? Is it really the whole point of life to get back to wherever that back is? Or is the point of life, this is my question, to experience the challenge of attempting to get back, that struggle to get back? For it conceivably could be the whole point of our existence to do that work. I find it interesting, and also Krishna brings this up in the Bhagavad Gita, the concept of work. Work, it's such an important concept in the Gita. The whole third chapter is dedicated to this discussion of work. It practically formulates the foundation upon which the whole discussion takes place. Work. Work is also combined with this idea of duty, that there's an obligation to work. There's not only an obligation, but there's a very specific reason to work. For example, Krishna says, without work, you can't even maintain your material body. Isn't that fascinating? Without work, you can't even maintain your own body. You need it. You've got to have it to get the blood moving. You've got to have it to have muscle tone, because without muscle tone, everything falls apart. Without it, you become basically just a vegetable, without movement, without motion, without dealing with the lifting of some kind of weight or the pushing against something. You know, when the astronauts are in outer space, they don't have any gravity, so they're not working at all. Here in this world, on this earth, we're, no matter what we are doing, we're performing some kind of work because we're countering the effects of gravity. Even when you lift your arm up, gravity actually wants it to fall down. That's why even lifting your arm up is to a certain extent, if not small, a work. In outer space, everything just floats around because there's no gravity pulling it down. So there they have to do this isometric type of exercises where they put one muscle against the other to give it some tension. Because the tension and release, it's a work, it maintains the body. The yoga practice for yogis who are in the performing meditation processes is not just some kind of preliminary exercise. It's also required for them to maintain their bodies. Because one who's simply absorbed in spirituality and doesn't do any activity or doesn't do any work can have such a deteriorated body that it affects the brain, it affects the mind. Because the brain, if you think about it, is intimately connected to all of the parts of the body, all of the cells, all of the functioning of the body. It's a connection. So the brain and the body, the brain is definitely part of the body, and the brain and the mind are also intimately connected because it's the interface by which the mind will have its consciousness, or the consciousness of the being will interface with the body. So Krishna also says that work is important because it's our livelihood. I mean, you have to eat. And part of the work is to grow food and then make it as an offering and have this reciprocating nourishment with the devas. The getting of food, the taking care of people you love, the helping others. All of this is very important activity. And everybody has their function. Everybody has their designated activity. Each person, each of us, we have some form of a designated activity. There's always something that we are doing that represents our means of work. So these ideas of struggling through or working your way through the challenge of this body to attain or to regain. Of course, I don't believe that word regain is correct. I don't believe there's a static soul who is already in its absolutely best condition it could possibly be. And our whole purpose of life is to reject the illusion of this so-called reality and become that again. That which you were infinitely long time ago, or God knows how long ago, when you were in your perfect position. I do not believe that's so. I personally am convinced, and it's my experience also to whatever degree I could experience it, that this idea is a myth. It's a myth. Maybe it's there to encourage a neophyte that you will get everything when you get there, when you get back to what you are, when you attain it, when you're there, then it'll all be great. So all you got to do is give up what's here and get to there. And then there are these formulas, you all know them, give some money, give some work, give up this, give up that, do this and do that. Perhaps there's value in this for those who are not very good at this spiritual business. But I don't even believe that. Because I see all around me, all the time, amongst all kinds of people, I see that everybody is struggling with the exact same issue, regardless if they are a member of a religion, they are in some spiritual group or not. And this exact same issue is to deal with this personality, our consciousness, our essence, if you will, which is working within the reality of this atmosphere, this environment, and is struggling continuously to keep it making sense, to have it be something which speaks to them as people. You can call this meaning of life. Raison d'être is a great French term. I love it. That reality, that essence of being, that very essence of my existence. I'm not sure how they would translate it, but I love to translate it that way. And this whole concept of making that connection between that me, which is the true me, and my world. And we find again and again in our own experiences, we've seen in this life how much we have grown. What very different people we are today than we were 10, 20, 30, 40, and so on, depending on your age, years ago. How we are so extremely more complex, more integrated, more in contact with certain important and valuable things. This whole idea of dealing with this world, dealing with our bodies, it's a continuous growth. Whether we want it to be or not, it is. Some people, of course, are coasting their way through life. Coasting, that means they're just kind of like going through life without struggle. They're just doing one thing after another. They don't think about it too much. They don't have too many problems. It's get up in the morning, do the same stuff, and go to bed at night, and it's okay. Others are engaged in an intense struggle. I've also seen that sometimes I also have fallen into the trap of wanting to analyze other people and come to some kind of judgment. Look at how they are acting. They are acting so badly. Therefore, they are kind of bad people. Or they are stupid. Or they are whatever. And I'm not saying everything is the same and all actions are just equally good or not. But I am saying that we cannot be sure about what the struggle is that these people have to go through. We are not aware of their life challenges and the way in which they have to face those life challenges. We are not aware of even a script of life which they are undergoing and which perhaps includes horrifying acts they are forced or they actually voluntarily do for the sake of extraordinarily growing or being of service to others who are extraordinarily growing. Therefore, the idea that somebody has to be great when they sit and do a broadcast, or they have to be perfect, or they have to really be professional, because there's a requirement there. I also don't accept that. If I wish to say, this is the way I am, this is how I feel, and this is the best I can do in this particular circumstance. Do you understand that? That's an important point to me. Do you understand that? Can you relate to the struggles that I might have? Can you relate to my particular situation here, which is rather unique? Can you relate to it? Does it make sense to you? Now, sometimes we think about people in a way according to our own conceptions, and this gets in the way of our quality of life. If you read English and you go to my robertcampagnola.com and you read my About Me, it's a kind of a musical biography. And an important part of that is that story I tell about Eric Clapton, that he had been in this club I was in when I was, I don't know, I guess I was around 17 or 18, I'm not sure, I don't remember exactly. It was in 1966, so that must, yeah, I had just probably just turned 18. And he was jamming with Mike Bloomfield, who none of you have ever heard about, because after all, he died when he was young, but he was at that time just the best guitar player. I mean, this guy was my hero. He was just fabulous. And here I was sitting in the Cafe Agogo. There may have been maximally six or eight people, I don't know, in the whole club. And here I am right in front of Paul Butterfield with Mike Bloomfield right next to him, listening to this incredible group. And I'm just going crazy. It's so wonderful. And afterwards, Eric Clapton comes out. Nobody at that time knew who he was, really. I mean, maybe some people who were into some English kind of esoteric stuff, but he was a very specialized item at that time. It was the first time he had come to America. He had just gotten off the airplane, probably in the afternoon and maybe the day before, I don't know. And he was jamming with Mike Bloomfield. And in those days, if you're going to jam with somebody, the whole point of the jam was like, okay, you're going to play together, but you're really going to show your stuff. There was this subtle and not so subtle, especially amongst guitar players, or any kind of player, really, this idea that you're going to show your stuff. You're really going to step out there and really display what you know how to do. I mean, just as a sidestep, I mean, I remember in my university, we had this huge hall, and at night, every musician in the whole school used to show up in this hall, and they would bring their guitar and their amp, and we'd have a piano there, and there would be a drummer, and the bass guy would be there. Basically, I was just playing backup piano for all of the jam sessions. I just played the backup piano, just, you know, played some stuff so these guitar players would be able to do their thing, and they would come one after another and play their thing. And I'd just be hitting like some chords here and there. A lot of it was blues, which is why I really can't stand the blues today. Because I remember just being forced to be the backup blues piano player. Oh, God, did I hate that after a while. It was like so wretched. But this was the idea. You'd come in and you'd present yourself. So here's Eric Clapton playing with Mike Bloomfield. And here's Mike Bloomfield. I mean, this guy could really play. He's like playing circles around Eric Clapton. And in my head, I was thinking, geez, this guy, Eric Clapton, he's not very good. I mean, he's never going to make it here in America. He can't play so good. This is what I'm thinking. I even made that prediction. He's never going to make it. This was my prediction about Eric Clapton, so you can just understand what I know. So, later on, much later on, I discovered that he had this quality that if he's playing with somebody and the other person wants really to show themselves, he always steps back. He always steps back and allows them to do whatever they want and does not try to present himself. In other words, the man is a cultured gentleman. And this is incredibly rare amongst musicians to meet cultured gentlemen who are not interested in presenting themselves, but are more interested in supporting someone else who wishes to do whatever it is they wish to do. Unless they are in the environment where presenting themselves is what they all together wish to do. So, when I finally understood this, it took some years, about Eric Clapton, I realized that this man is a cultured gentleman, and I respected that so much. My respect for him went from here I was judging him to be like hopeless to one of my real role models, an example. Like this person was really a significant person in his desire to take a step back. And you will see amongst spiritually evolved people, this is just an example before about him, but you will see about spiritually evolved people that one of their qualities is they're shy. They actually have a different kind of conception about themselves than what you would expect. They do not feel comfortable pushing themselves forward. I think about this a lot in terms of what people require from a leader. People need as a leader somebody who really establishes, who leads, who says, I have the clear vision, follow me, because a leader is only a leader when there are followers. So follow me to this destination, I will bring you there. Now, the idea that I know and I will bring you somewhere, it's very much similar to this idea that the goal or the whole point of life is to get back to wherever it may be, that spiritual realm somewhere, that heaven somewhere. And that this leadership is that somebody will lead you back to. Now that's two very linked and two very interesting concepts. There is a place where you should be, and the whole point of where you are now is to get there, and a person will lead you there. And that you just simply have to accept that person and accept the leadership and get there. These two concepts are very interestingly connected. Now, there are other ideas which I find more attractive in my personal life. These ideas are attractive in terms of, well, I question this concept. I question the concept of I have to get somewhere. What if there's really nowhere to go? What if I'm already there? Maybe I just have to experience that. Maybe the whole point of my life is not getting somewhere, but rather being here now. Perhaps that's much more important. Sometimes, you know, I read books to review them for our publishing company over there. And now I've got a book. It's about like this green kind of consciousness. Green in the sense of connecting with nature. And finally, I'm reading a book about somebody who also talks to plants. Because, you know, I've been kind of like feeling sometimes a little bit embarrassed to even tell people, well, I also talk to plants. I've been doing it for a long, long time, and I really love plants. I love trees. But here's this lady who's coming right out and saying it in print. And not only that, but she's teaching people in her book how also to talk to plants. She goes even further, how to listen to the wind, to hear its message, how to talk or to connect to rocks. Rocks, I mean, like, well, that's a little bit too much way out there for me. But back to plants. So the methodology for connecting with plants, it's like really interesting because plants are very interesting consciousness. Plants have nothing to do. Isn't that cool? They have nothing to do. They just are. I think this is so incredibly cool. For me, this is like the most amazing thing. I look out my window. Now I have all my windows open because I need light in here for the camera. So there's all those plants out there. And they have nothing to do. They don't have to go anywhere. In fact, they can't go anywhere. Can you imagine if plants were walking around? I mean, my God, that would be chaos. The trees walking around and the plants walking around. I mean, that you would have a hard time with your garden if your lettuce moved over to the front lawn and, you know, your grass moved over to the back and your tomato plants, you know, they were crawling up your walls. And I mean, it would be very interesting. Plants have nowhere to go. They don't go anywhere. They don't have legs. They don't move. And it's not like they have a problem with that. It's not like they consider themselves deficient because they can't go somewhere. They are very satisfied standing there. They just stay. And their consciousness is so beautiful. Okay, not every plant. Some plants I don't like. I admit it. I mean, some plants I just don't like. There's something about them. I don't know. I don't like them. When I go to the store, when we buy plants, you know, I check them out. What kind of plant are you? You know, basically, or if you ever watch Heroes, that guy who's always trying to get in everybody's head. So I go to the plant and I'm like, and like, who are you and what are you into their plant? And if the plant speaks in a very compatible kind of a way, so I'm like, okay, you're a very nice plant. Next question is, can you tolerate freeze because our weather around here has been horrible? So, okay, you're a good plant to put there in the ground. You can join the family. We have a family of plants here. All the plants are friends with each other. And it's a very compatible environment. I used to go in the spring in Oxia, where we lived in Sweden. And I would go out into the forest in the spring when the trees just all of a sudden woke up. And I would walk in the forest and all of the trees were just screaming greetings. It was just every plant was greeting every plant and the whole forest was just screaming with this beautiful greeting and joy, and it was wonderful. It got quieter as we got nearer to the fall, and then it just became quiet after the fall ended. But that spring, when it was all just like an instantly, this waking up, this just reaching out to the to the spring, embracing the warmth, embracing the sun, this beautiful being of just this existence of all these wonderful plants. And they just grow. They don't have anything they have to accomplish. This idea of this being right here in the now, it's just such a beautiful concept to just share with plants. Because if you ever don't feel like that, and I could probably guarantee you'd feel like that quite a lot. If you ever don't feel in the now and connected to your being, just go to nature. Sit amongst the trees, amongst the plants, and just listen. Just accept the environment. After a short while, if you're sensitive, you will experience that buzzing. Not in a sound kind of buzzing, but I mean buzzing as in a connection, a connectivity to the frequency of the plants, the frequency of the trees, the frequency of nature, the frequency of the birds who are so perfectly connected with all the vegetation, with the other animals living in nature. And we've been so disconnected from nature. We live in our buildings. We live with our tools and our machines and our electronics. And we live in cities. We are so disconnected from nature. We are so disconnected from everything around us. And yet, in nature, it is connected. It's all connected. The plants are all connected, intertwined with the earth, and the earth is the support. And you can just feel that all the plants are grabbing the earth with their roots and rushing up to the sky. It's almost as if the earth is expanding its consciousness upwards through the plants and vegetation. And when you are just connected in that very gorgeous being, you can just connect again to that essence within yourself, which also has nothing to do. Nothing that it has to do. But it chooses to do. And when it chooses to do, it chooses to do for very significant reasons. After all, the animals are also going and doing things because they need to find their food by moving. They need to find food and shelter by moving themselves and accomplishing things. So we and the animals share that very well. We also, in our being here, when we are just trying to figure out what it is we do, if we are conscious of this question, where am I going? What am I doing here? Is the point really to get somewhere? Or is it the point to be? To be here and now, wherever it may be. The whole question of evolution is a very interesting question, because why do I do what I do? If your answer is to get somewhere, I think you would not be very satisfied with your life. If your idea is to do what you do to get somewhere, you're in a constant state of transit. Can just use this example and just imagine this. You're going to go on a vacation. So the entire time is spent getting to the beach. You're just driving and walking and taking a bus and flying and taking a boat and digging a tunnel and building a bridge. And you're constantly in transit to get to the beach. And your whole life is just absorbed in this transiting, this process of getting, this process of going, the idea that when you get to the beach, you will be there. And then all of a sudden, this whole activity, which has become your whole existence, will just stop. And then you'll just be somewhere in a totally different state, and all of the struggle will dissolve. Why do we feel like that? Well, I might suggest because that's exactly what happens every time we die. We get freed from this struggling of motion and movement in the body, getting somewhere all the time, struggling to get somewhere all the time. And then we're in this state where we connect to our essence, or more of it. We connect to a higher realm of our being, and we just experience that spirit, or at least the consciousness that is not chained anymore to the struggle of this world. And we feel good about it. And we feel like, yes, that is home. That is where. But then we come back. Then we come back. Isn't that interesting? We actually have, I mean, I'm quoting also now this book that I read also about these between live regressions that they do and the experience of the people speak about in between lives. So it's very interesting that our life is a transit through this body, working hard, going places, doing things, establishing ourselves. And then at death, we find ourselves in this wonderful situation where we're together with other souls, with our group, with those people who are most significant to us. And we are experiencing knowledge and understanding. And then we come back again and start it all over again. And perhaps this conception we have, I think it's so, but I have to say perhaps because I can't say it is a fact. After all, what do I know whether it's a fact? But I have a very strong idea in this way that perhaps it is so that this entire idea in life that life is meant to get us somewhere, as if we're constantly on our way to vacation, which is why often many people think if I can only just die, then I'll be peaceful. I'll be there. I'll get to where I'm going. The whole point is to get to that between life stage when we feel comfort. We feel sheltered. We feel protected. But I want to contrast that with Lord Chaitanya's idea. Lord Chaitanya had another idea. I want to contrast this whole idea with that. Because if you think about the time when Sanatana Goswami wanted to kill himself by throwing himself under the wheels of the cart, the Rath Yatra cart. And Lord Chaitanya said, if I could attain the Supreme by killing myself, by destroying this body, I would have destroyed millions of bodies. If it was that easy, I would just be killing myself time after time, whatever it would take. But it was not so. And people think about Lord Chaitanya as the Yuga avatar, the personality who gave the practices of the age. Yet they miss this incredibly important point, that life is not meant for death. And Lord Chaitanya's whole life was this moving into the Spirit right now, to be in that consciousness right now. In other words, not to make this dichotomy between matter and spirit, not to make this life a transit to some place, but to expand the consciousness of being such that life is a manifestation of being. That what I am, what is, what this reality is the spirit, the consciousness of the spirit, the essence, being the predominating factor in my life. Now, it's interesting, Lord Chaitanya's appearance day is on Tuesday here, maybe some other time in another place. But I think about his example a lot. I see his whole example of being the perfection of the union between the male and female. Not as a unique thing that is only possible in Lord Chaitanya. I see it as the model for the human beings to reunite and wholeness, and to have their consciousness, therefore, connected with their spiritual essence, their spiritual being, and that their actions, that their works, or that which they connect to, or that those to whom they are of service to, is an expression of the being of that love, which is now complete because it is no longer seeking or searching after completeness of the male and female energy, or the completeness of Radha and Krishna. I ask you a question. I put a challenge to you to think about. If you are one with God, which God are you one with? If you are one and different with God, is it that you are one with Krishna? Then that means God is simply Krishna. But Lord Chaitanya showed, and he's the Yuga Avatar, Radha Krishna, the union of Radha and Krishna. This is the Supreme. So are you one with Krishna? Well, then you're one half. Are you one with Radha? Then you are one half. Are you one with Radha Krishna? Then you are one. If you are one with Radha and Krishna, then you are also that same combination of the union of that which is one with Krishna, one with Radha, united as one with Radha Krishna. Now, this is obvious. It's not like this is a huge revelation. It's obvious. But allowing yourself to think like this, not obvious. Intellectually, if you say it, somebody might say, oh, what an interesting point. Because the intellect can grapple such kinds of discussion, can grab it, can massage these concepts in the intellect, and feel very good about such a massage, such an intellectual thought. It's exciting, it's interesting. But when you request the being to embrace that, this is something very radical. Can you imagine for how many lifetimes, some number I could put on it, it would mean nothing. How many lifetimes all people have been told, taught, it's insisted that they think of themselves as related to that male god, Krishna, as if you will, or Allah, or whoever, male god. And not only that, but we're just an itsy-bitsy, little, teeny-weeny, sinful, fallen, useless, disconnected little entity. So this is drilled into our consciousness. It's drilled into our collective memory. It's drilled into the ether everywhere. These ideas reverberate in the ether. This is a background frequency of reverberation. I would call it a ground loop in electronics. There's a hum. There's a hum there in the ether. And that hum insists that your identity is this. And your choice is to either accept it and be a theist, or to reject it and be an atheist, or some other form of a mixture of this God knows what. But this idea that we are discussing here is meant to fix the ground loop by not lifting the wire. Okay, I'm going to get technical here. You know, sometimes you lift the ground loop by taking the grounds off and the electricity. Okay, we're not going to do that. We're going to resolve the source of the ground loop at its source. At the very source, we're going to stop the ground loop by changing that idea which creates it. And to really appreciate Lord Chaitanya, really for the first time in modern history anyway, I've never heard people really embrace Lord Chaitanya totally as the Yuga avatar. In fact, I've heard people say, he brought chanting of Hare Krishna. Okay, sure. He brought chanting of Hare Krishna, and therefore you should chant Hare Krishna, and that's it. That's okay if you want to do that, and I do it too sometimes. It's okay. It's not a problem. But the idea being, what about everything else? What about this full absorption in that consciousness of being the essence of spirit, the essence of love right now? So that this world becomes the extension of the spirit. This body is the expansion of the spirit. And the secret to this, if you look at Lord Chaitanya's fundamental quality, which allowed him to do this in that supreme fashion, is the union of Radha and Krishna, that he is. And I repeat, if you are one, you must be one with Radha Krishna, who are one. It's not like you have to make them one. They already are one. And when you make that one your one, then you understand the oneness. Naturally, the difference is there because you are part of that consciousness. But when you make a oneness, the usness, as we have discussed it, between us, with us, as us, But then you will understand what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. When you have known the truth, you'll know that all living beings are in Krishna. They are all of Krishna. And Krishna is Radha Krishna, as Lord Chaitanya explained. So there is that oneness of us. And there can never be anything else than us. That us where we are joined and embraced. You cannot make this usness if you are one with Krishna, for example. Just Krishna. As nice as that may sound philosophically, somebody may very perfectly explain it. Somebody may have arguments and perhaps create all kinds of beautiful debates and beautiful defeating others without any conception that there could be possibly any other idea, and walk away feeling very happy and satisfied that they have established the truth. But in reality, if you want to see Lord Chaitanya as the Yuga avatar, why assume only one part of his life was that? Why not understand this union of Radha and Krishna in the self? This idea to feel that in oneself. That's why I like nature. It's not that I spoke about nature because I'm somebody who wanders through all kinds of subjects here without any connection. Sitting in nature, you can understand that connection between all that is there in nature. You can also understand why right now the weather is so terribly bad. Because of everybody's fear, because of the economic situation of the world, their fear is blasting into the ether. And nature is responding that the weather patterns, which are 100% connected to the consciousness of the people of this planet, are manifesting strangely. Strangely. Nature and us are intimately connected. And it is very good that nowadays we can understand the very significant connection of Lord Shiva and Goddess Parvati and this world because of the mother and father of this universe. Goddess Parvati is Mother Nature. Lord Shiva is the seed-giving father. This connection of nature, this connection to them, will allow us to understand how our bodies, how our world around us is also very much connected with this usness. That life is not a journey to get somewhere. Life is right now. And the only way you're going to get where you think you should be is to be there now. Not that you're going to die and get somewhere. It's to be there now, to embrace the spirituality now, to embrace that real essence of what is Lord Chaitanya now. And that, I feel, is the whole point. Not that we're going to get somewhere. Not that we're going to do something. But rather we're going to be there now. To be this us. And all of these other points are that when you feel like this, you don't engage yourself in egoistic activities. Because you have nothing to prove. You don't engage yourself in judging others. Because in reality, you would be judging yourself in one way or another. And your judgment would bring about some pain to another person, which would be your pain. because we are all connected. And the more we cause trouble to nature, or the more we cause trouble to other persons, or the more we cause trouble to animals, or the more we cause trouble to ourselves, the more that pain increases. We're not part of the healing. And Lord Chaitanya's whole point was to share his healing, to share his consciousness, to share his love by embracing others and infusing within them his experience, the connection of Radha and Krishna, that love which is there, and creating this beautiful reality which is right now. And that is how I end this for today. And again, I really hope that you're catching this, what I'm saying, because for me, it's like very exciting to even be able to say it. I feel honored to be able to share it. I feel that it's a great gift that we all share. And the more we share it, the more we'll just expand that gift to ourselves and everyone around us.